The title for this session is Digital Praxis, number one, so it's part of a small series of them, Public-Private Partnerships and Queer Ownership. In the program, which went out a few days ago, we had four papers. We're down to three. Amy's been shifted to another session, so if you're interested in her topic, she is here. Just check the revised program. Three papers, but four speakers. Dawn and Philip are going to share the first paper. Because it's been, the number of papers has been contracted, we can be a little bit relaxed about the length of the papers, although everyone had already previously timed them, so we should be okay for that. It does mean we might have a little bit more time for questions. We're going to take questions at the end of each paper, just to make sure that people don't forget what they were going to ask the first and second speakers. And then, as I say, we'll have a bit of time left over at the end if we decide we want it. Of course, we're also starting 15 minutes late, which is tremendously un-German. I'm beyond belief. I can only assume it was all the foreigners on the panel who disrupted the start. But again, that does mean we've kind of got some time to play with. So our first speakers with the... Sorry, I've also forgotten my glasses. Don McLeod and Philip Berta, looking at Gail's Archives of Sexuality and Gender and the experience of the Archives, Canada's LGBTQ2+ Archives. The speakers, Don McLeod, has a long-term member of the Archives, which is based in Toronto. He's also the Head of Books and Serials Acquisitions at the University of Toronto Library, a long-time volunteer at the Archives, which is the recently renamed Canadian Lesbian and Gay Archives, an issue that a lot of us are grappling with and which, in fact, there is a session on later. Philip is the Acquisition Editor for Gale Archives of Sexuality and Gender Programs, and they'll be addressing that program and how the Archives and the Gale Project work together. Thank you.
I suppose we have to start the... Let's see if we can start the actual presentation.
Down the bottom?
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I've got where to exit it.
I can't get that to work. There it is. Is that you?
That looks like it.
That's you.
Should have brought my glasses.
Yes. Note to self, bring glasses to things.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry.
I'm getting older.
Well, it's better than the alternative.
Okay.
Can you blow that up?
Yeah, I'm going to work on that. Again, with bringing glasses. There we go. There's the little thing. I got it.
Thank you.
Also. Okay. Guten Morgen, meine Damen und Herren. Buenos dias, damas y caballeros. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. That's about the extent of the language knowledge I have. So we will go forward. My name is Philip Werther. And as Graham has nicely said, I am the editor in charge of Gale's Archives of Sexuality and Gender Program. I would like to say that I'm happy to be here, and you don't have to be queer to love, respect, and support the queer community. Also encourage you, if you happen to go out the front door, have a look at the sidewalk down on the left-hand side as you go out. There are two small brass plaques. It's a very interesting bit of history. I encourage you to go have a look and see what you learn. And I am also here with Don, of course, Don McLeod from University of Toronto Library. So we're going to be presenting a little adventure as we go along, Raiders of the Lost Archives, so going into the vaults of Canada's archives. But it is an honor to be among the first speakers to address this conference of like-minded individuals on the site where Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexualwissenschaft once stood. And as has already been mentioned, Dr. Hirschfeld worked to promote sexual science and homosexual rights, even though many times it was at his own peril. His archives and library on sexuality must have been amazing, yet, of course, they were sadly destroyed by the National Socialists in 1933. But I do believe Dr. Hirschfeld's legacy lives on in all the work being carried out by every one of us here today. We represent the past, present, and future of queer memory. So on that note, please allow me to introduce Gale's Archives of Sexuality and Gender. I'll refer to it in an acronym form as ASG throughout this brief talk. ASG is a digital primary source archive program representing over 4 million pages of material across three archives currently. Two represent LGBTQ history and culture in the 20th century, and one presents books covering subjects in sex and sexuality from the 16th to 20th centuries. Among the many interesting topical areas you can find, ASG allows readers to examine how sexual norms have changed over time, health and hygiene, the development of sex education, the rise of sexology, changing gender roles, LGBTQ culture, social movements, activism, and as well erotica. There's a fourth archive in the works. It will focus on LGBTQ history and culture in Southern Africa with our partner, Gay and Lesbian Memory in Action, or GALA. You'll see them here. And as well as Australia, of course, Graham Willett, with the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. And the program will continue to grow beyond that. We queer memory at GALE as we work with our partner institutions to digitize historical collections. We make them available for research and education purposes while digitally preserving analog materials. I'm pleased that many of the institutional partners that I have worked with are here today. Many of these partners house the leading LGBTQ institutional and library collections in the world, and some are community-based organizations which maintain the rich history of their own LGBTQ communities, so those stories will not be forgotten. We've worked closely with our partners to digitize a wide range of materials, from personal papers to records of political and social organizations, books to ephemera, newsletters to magazines, manuscripts and pamphlets, in over 30 languages from more than 45 countries. And this diversity of materials provides historical breadth and depth to the study of sex, sexuality, and gender. So from 16 institutional partners so far, we have digitized 54 unique collections. There are nearly 30 more collections on the way in the next archive. We preserve and present full collections of materials from our partners. We allow readers and researchers to explore the historical record in its entirety rather than present them with an edited and selected version of history. We work closely with our partner institutions to clear copyrights, to gain permissions, and to provide collections that are relevant, historical, and unique for academic research and general readers. And ultimately, we strive to ensure that a record of queer memory is preserved for future generations. Now, I don't have time to provide an overview of every collection in the Archives of Sexuality and Gender, but here are some highlights that I feel illustrate aspects of queering memory. The first, on the upper left there, really represents inclusivity. It's from the Hall Carpenter Archives at the London School of Economics. The papers of the Lesbian and Gay Christian Movement, the LGCM, was founded as an ecumenical organization aiming to encourage fellowship, friendship, and support amongst gay Christians, to help the church re-examine its understanding of human sexuality, to advocate for lesbian and gay civil rights, to encourage the witness of Christian faith within the gay community, and to network with other groups. Coming out experiences. On the lower left, we have from the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives, the Robert Rosencrantz letters. So in 1985, if you're not familiar with Rosencrantz, he shot and killed a schoolmate who bullied him for his homosexuality. He subsequently went to prison for the crime, and while I don't condone his actions, I do like this archive because it includes letters and cards of support with many correspondents writing of their own experiences coming out or being outed. And just to be clear, due to the sensitive and personal nature of the correspondence, identifying information has been redacted to protect privacy. In the middle, we have Inspiring Her Story from the Women's Library at the London School of Economics. These are the papers of Vera Jack Holm, and I labeled it Inspiring Her Story as it documents the colorful life of this British actress, suffragist, chauffeur, and World War I ambulance driver. Holm, 1881 to 1969, went by the name of Jack, wore men's clothes, and had a female partner, Evelina Haverfield. The archive consists of diaries, correspondence, photographs, and memorabilia relating to Holmes' activities as a suffragette, her work with the Women's Volunteer Reserve and the Scottish Women's Hospital Unit during the First World War, her visits to and relief work in Serbia and Yugoslavia, and her personal lives and life and friendships. And I just love it. It's a really it's an inspiring collection. She led such a fabulous life. Erotica and Obscene Books. This is the private case from the British Library. It was originally comprised of more than 4,000 obscene, quote-unquote, books kept locked away in cases or cupboards in the keeper's room. And today there are just over 2,500 volumes in the private case, and a number of books were moved out of the collection over time as social mores changed. The private case consists mostly of erotic printed fiction and poetry with some social science material dating from the late 17th century through to the 20th century. ephemeral art, and this is actually from our friends in Canada, posters from the Canadian Lesbian Gay Archives, which are now the archives. So queer art is well represented in this collection of posters from around the world. The collection colorfully depicts LGBTQ life, ranging from meetings, events, and community outreach to LGBTQ entertainment and other social activities. Ephemera such as posters don't always survive very well, as they're intended for one-time use and then generally get forgotten or discarded. The Archives has curated a substantial poster collection which preserves these windows into LGBTQ history for future generations. And last on the lower right, just to point out, this is one of the new ones coming out from Gala. We have the Simon Nicolai collection, which covers the most significant period in lesbian and gay political history in South Africa. Nicolai was a prominent South African anti-apartheid, gay and lesbian rights, and HIV/AIDS activist. The highlight of the collection is over 100 letters written during Nicolai's detention in the Delmas treason trial, which was 1985 to 1987. These letters are a testimony to Nicolai's extraordinary courage and, through this personal account, give an insight into the day-to-day experience of being in detention. Almost there. So here we go. Tying these collections together are ASG's features and functionality, the Archives of Sexuality and Gender, as a digital archive, just like all Gale archives, are fully text and keyword searchable. Users can search across the content using basic or advanced search options. They can refine search results using a variety of limiters, and they can analyze the contents using powerful tools such as term frequency and term clusters. And there are other features such as cross-search capability, downloadable OCR, digital humanities support, integrated workflow tools such as Zotero compatibility, and user-generated tags and annotations, all in the support of academic research and in furthering queer history. All right, so enough from me. It is now my great pleasure to introduce Don McLeod. Don represents the Archives, again, the Canada's LGBTQ2+ Archives, and he's going to take you on a little tour of their experience of queering memory with the Archives of Sexuality and Gender as a case study. And I'll drive here.
Good morning, and thank you for coming. I will give a basic overview of the Archives as a case study of working with Gale and the ASG project, what we did, how we did it, and why. The Archives began in 1973 and is now one of the largest community-based queer archives in the world. When we started, we were a total archive, collecting all manner of items that might be of interest to queer research. Our focus was on Canada, but we also collected internationally. Today, we've built up some significant collections, mostly through donations, including not only traditional archival records, but also serials, more than 10,000 titles, thousands of vertical files on individuals and organizations, a large poster collection, a library, and many pamphlets. In 2005 and 2006, we partnered with Primary Source Microfilm, a subsidiary company of Gale, to do international gay and lesbian periodicals and newsletters, Part 11 of its Gay Rights Movement series. Part 11 included 211 reels of microfilm of queer serials titles, which was a huge project. There were 87 reels of Canadian serials alone, and as well as serials from 45 other countries. Coordination of the project at the Archives was handled by Alan V. Miller, who is the Archives serials curator, and filming was done off-site by a third party. Sales went well. We received a royalty based on sales, one positive and one negative version of the finished microfilm, and a considerable publicity for the project. Our relationship with Gale was further enhanced when in 2015 they decided to release the 12 parts of the Gay Rights Movement project as a new consolidated digital project, the ASG Part 1. The original files from Primary Source Microfilm's Gay Rights Movement were digital, filmed at 300 dpi. ASG was designed to be expanded into further parts through digitization of additional materials. Gale's ASG Part 1 launched in March 2015 and has sold well. The Archives receives a royalty based on annual sales and also a copy of the digital files of the materials digitized for the product. These have been loaded on our internal server and have become a popular, fully searchable research tool for visitors to the Archives. The Archives continued its relationship with Gale for Part 2 of ASG, which was compiled during 2016 and 2017. I was part of the advisory board for Part 2 and worked with other scholars and librarians to develop the work. And here you see some members of the board meeting in New York in March 2016. Left to right is Giulio Capo Jr., Jason Bauman, and Jen Mannion. The Archives Serials Collections also were, again, a focus of ASG Part 2, especially the Canadian titles produced by Pink Triangle Press. More than 50 queer serials titles were scanned, 223,543 images in total. Gail also scanned the entire poster collection that we have, which is more than 3,000 images, and the entire international vertical files collection, which would be 4,381 files containing many thousands of images of clippings and flyers on individuals and organizations outside of Canada and the United States. The scanning was done at the archives, thus allowing us to still access the materials. The scanning itself began in August 2016 and was conducted according to a mutually agreed upon schedule. A detailed inventory of materials to be scanned was maintained during the entire process. Weekly meetings were held by telephone to track progress and to deal with any problems. Scanning was done on site in the top floor meeting area of the archives by RISTEC Company Incorporated of Burlington, Ontario, using two Book2Net Kiosk Profi A2 scanners. You'll see one in the picture here. With two operators. A third scanner with operator was introduced to speed up their project later. Images were scanned using a color profile optical 400 ppi, 16.7 million, 24-bit TIFF uncompressed file using a TIFF extension. Completed scans were sent on drives by courier to Gail's content operations team in Meriden, Connecticut. This team oversaw quality control of the images, which were uploaded into quality assurance QA environment. Images were examined for quality control and a number of rescans were ordered. All metadata captured from the original source was compiled and edited by a vendor in India, which was then reviewed by Gail. Final scanning at the archives was completed in April 2017. ASG Part 2 was officially released in August 2017. The archives receives a royalty based on annual sales, as well as a digital copy of the scans and material which were done, like the earlier files, are available on our internal network for use by researchers at the archives. Now, why did the archives become involved in these projects? I think there are several reasons. First of all, to help preserve the queer historical record and to make documentary sources relating to it more widely available. Second, to help with the preservation of our own physical holdings through microfilming and digitization, which we could not afford to do on our own. Third is to help publicize our own holdings through involvement in the project and through the marketing powers of a large company. Fourth, to improve our own access to and searching of materials that are being digitized through loading the searchable files on our internal server. And fifth, to add an additional revenue stream to through license payments from Gail, which have been substantial. In conclusion, what are the future prospects for Gail and the archives? Gail launched the ASG Part 3 in 2019, which we were not involved with, but there are plans to do subsequent parts. The archives still has substantial holdings that could be scanned and made available, and we hope to be part of this. Gail has been highly professional in its relationship with the archives, and there would be no serious issues that would make us reconsider partnering with them in such a useful and successful enterprise. Thank you.
Questions and comments as we go, so after each paper. So if anybody's got a question or comments, I invite you to raise your hand.
Hi. What sort of metadata was collected as a part of the digitization?
We cooperated with the family providing some of the material, for example, with the files, and we had to know.
Hello?
Yes, we cooperated with them in providing some of the information. We had internal files on some of the things that were digitized, so provided that information for them, including titles and places of publication and that sort of thing.
We also collect all the folder information. If there are file folders, boxes, we collect anything on publishers, we collect anything on authors. As much information as we can provide is included with the files, so it's... It depends on the type of material you're working with, but we provide as much as we can.
And do you conform to a particular standard for that metadata, or is that a Gale in-house standard?
It's a Gale in-house standard. There's also Library of Congress has some, but I think Library of Congress is a little outdated in what they do in their standards, I hate to say. But, yeah, so we have our own internal standard as well, but we make sure it is easily findable, searchable across all of our products.
Is that standard publicly available for other people to use, or is that strictly kept within Gale?
That's a good question that I don't know the answer to, but if you'd like to find me later, I'll be sure I can get it to you if that's the case.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Can you hear me okay? Thanks for your talk. I always wonder about things around ethics in digitizing materials like this, because typically it was not designed for the audience that's actually accessing it right now. Having combed through a number of different newsletters before, I've been like, oh, that's really surprising that that thing that was intended for 200 people is now available for a massive audience. So I guess I'm kind of wondering about how you deal with the ethics more granularly. I know you were talking about attaining copyright and things like that, which is often really difficult in publications like that, I think. And if you've had sort of like takedown, like what is the process around when someone is like, actually, I don't want this to be accessible? I guess I'm just thinking of certain, like Honor Backs magazine was digitized a while ago, and I know a number of people who had material that was in there that they didn't want up there for a variety of reasons, right, with their job or, you know, things like that. So just kind of curious if you could speak to that. Thanks.
Well, thank you. It's a very good question, and I've heard that quite often. The Honor Backs issue came up with another institution I was working with. We do work closely with each partner institution to ensure that the materials we're looking at were either freely donated, were freely given, have full clearance, or we can gain copyright clearance or permission from heirs or the actual person or persons involved. I understand there are issues where, oh my goodness, you know, that was 20 years ago. I didn't expect that I was ever going to be spread all over the internet. You're not. These collections are provided to academic institutions. They are kept behind a paywall, essentially, but they're in academic institutions for research purposes. If there ever is an instance where we have to take something down, we will. We have been contacted in the past. If we can't work with that individual person or publication or heirs of people, then we will actually take the material out. I'm not in a position, and I'm not wanting to out anybody. I'm not wanting anyone to be in danger, and I am especially sensitive to that. Again, we also redact information if it's deemed too sensitive to include. And in many cases, if we really shouldn't include it, we don't include it.
Hi, Philip. Terry from the GLBT Historical Society. And we've enjoyed working with you very much on the first two phases. My question is really, I think in our contract, it provides for a sunset for Gale ownership of the, or access to the data that's digitized, so it reverts back to our organization after, I think it's 7 years, something like that. Is that correct?
Yes, and well, I should point that out. So I've heard quite often, oh, you're a big commercial publisher, you're out there just for money, you're out there just to make a fast dollar, or fast euro, whatever the case, and you have no real interest in querying memory and in preserving history. But that's really not the case. The idea is to partner with institutions that otherwise would not be able to do these kind of projects. And once you do that, of course, I don't want to own this forever. I don't own the material. I put it out there for research purposes. In almost every agreement I've ever written, it says after a certain period of time where we just hope to recoup our costs of doing the work and fund future projects, everything reverts back to the institution. You can do what you want with it. You can put it all out, open access on the web, whatever you like. I just want to be able to help preserve these collections. That's my business model. And forgive me for being a publisher. That's what I do. But I do believe it's important in querying memory to be able to do this kind of work.
Dan Zhang from University of California, Irvine before. I want to endorse Phil's point is Jonathan Katz was on the board of ASRG and asked me to join, and I did. And usually I don't like to work with corporations, and so I thought a lot about it. And I have my own personal archive, which maybe I'll give it to you guys later, but or lend it. But the point is, they do provide resources. One example is I wrote letters to Lesbian History Archive back in the 70s, and the letters showed up in the Gale product and database, and I didn't know that. But I was fine with it because I'm an activist and I don't care that my stuff is out there. So I mean, it's impossible for any database producer to get clearance for every item. That's just impossible. And they usually go with the editors of the publication, not with the article writers, because that's just the way to do it. You know, it's impossible to get every writer in a publication. So I've done web crawling of protest movements around the world, and especially Hong Kong, for UC Irvine. And we didn't actually go ask every site permission, because we tried, but then it seems like I've gone to web archiving conferences once at Michigan, and they said that the people said that basically nobody answers. You ask for a permission letter, you send a request, and nobody ever responds. So the result is actually is this takedown policy. If anybody complains, we'll take it down. But nobody almost ever complains. So I like the idea that Phil has offered is after 7 years, the Lesbian History Archive gets back its file. It has its file when it's digitized, of the what's been digitized, and can use it in-house. But after 7 years, they can do whatever they want with it online or outside on the internet. And right now, many actually libraries have gotten it, even in Asia. I come from Hong Kong originally. A couple of libraries in Hong Kong have acquired the first part or second part of the Gay Liberation publications. And the University of California, where I'm based, after I left, they actually acquired the whole set for part one, two, and three. So I think, including the erotica from the British Museum. So I think that's a boon for researchers in gender studies and in queer studies. Thanks.
Just quickly, while the mic is moving over, the idea is not exploitation, but education. And you can't educate if it's locked away somewhere. Not everyone has access to long distance flights and cash to travel and go visit each of these archives. It's making it available. That's what I want to do.
I'm sorry, maybe you addressed it, but I missed this information. Where you keep these digitized materials?
I'm sorry, where do we keep?
Digitized materials.
The digitized materials exist on a server, actually multiple redundant servers, and then it also goes to a company called Portico, which basically keeps, if the worst were to happen and everything blows up, at least Portico supposedly maintains a very secure server under a mountain somewhere. I don't know for certain, but the idea is multiple redundant servers to maintain the information. It's available digitally then, and institutions get these archives and make them available to their student populations, public libraries, etc.
And last question, how much does it cost?
It varies, but that's always the fun one. I'm not the salesperson. I get to make these things, so I don't deal with the cost generally. But the idea is that it's based on institutional size. Smaller institutions, there's a lower price point, so they can actually get these. Bigger institutions, if you're Harvard, if you're Yale, yeah, it's going to cost more. What's the minimum? It could be as low as $5,000. It could be as low as $4,000. It can go up to $60,000. Again, it depends on the size of the institution. It's a one-time payment. Once they get it, it's not a subscription. So we're not soaking anyone for money like that. It's the matter of they want to get it for their student population, for their researchers, for their faculty. They purchase it, and they own the material.
But if it's archive which is run by initiatives, like small initiatives groups, and it's from Ukraine, for example, mm-hmm. how much it will cost for them? because 5,000 for them, for individual, it's unbearable money.
Speaking mostly of the North American market, it varies by market, and it's the salespeople, of course, are interested in making money, but they're also interested in working with institutions. It's not going to cost anything like that. So it's dependent on ability. So
Well, the cost, I think, I don't know which cost you meant. The cost to actually access the materials that are already there, or the costs to collaborate with, to collaborate and get the work done?
If that was a question, not actually an institution purchasing, but the cost to collaborate, there is no cost to collaborate. There's no charge to you as an institution. The idea is Gail actually takes the material, Gail pays for everything. We do all the digitization work. If you need extra help, we will pay for extra help. We do all the metadata, the OCR. We pay for everything because we are interested in getting this information out and getting you a digital copy for your own uses and for that of your research body. So institution-wise, it doesn't cost you anything.
Thank you.
So to actually do the work, it doesn't cost anything, and you would be signing an agreement with Gail, and of course you would receive royalties based on sales of this. So you would base the royalties received would be based on a yearly payment. So these can be fairly substantial, depending on how much is actually done at the institution.
I'll contact the royalties department on that. If you are interested in talking more, if you have a collection or collections you'd like to work with us on, I'd be happy to, of course. I do like acquiring new collections, but I'm just down here in the little cave underneath the stairs and on the underfloor, so look for the Gale table. We'll be happy to talk to you, or just come find me here. I'd love to speak with you. And then there's a two-week free trial. I'd be happy to extend it to a month. If you want to actually see how these things work, we'd be happy to set you up and get you so you can actually access the 4 million pages of material. And there's the end. Okay. Thank you.
People in technology, we shouldn't be allowed. Tuula is a gender studies scholar at
Turku
University in Finland, and she'll be speaking to the topic up there. Thank you.
So thank you for everybody for coming here. This is going to be quite a jump in a scale because I'm going to talk about a really, really tiny project that was running last year. I read this article titled The Rise and Fall of Gay, a Cultural Historical Approach to Gay Identity Development, which inspired me to initiate a project to collect written reminiscences of LGBTQ+ in collaboration with the Labour Archives in Finland. It is, along with the Labour Museum Verstas, in the absence of a specific queer archive or museum in Finland, one of the two publicly funded memory institutions with a national responsibility to collect and preserve LGBTQI histories. In 2018, the Labour Oral History Committee of the Labour Archives agreed to collaborate with my University of Turku-based project called Most Memorable Moments. Our collaboration had some obvious benefits. The collected data increased their collections. It's immediately, safely, and permanently stored and easily available for future scholars. In my presentation, I explicate the good and less fortunate decisions I made in this Labour Archives research-geared collection project. I will focus on the drafting of the call and marketing it to various audiences, and contemplate how the decisions made affected the quality of the responses we received. I also make some initial observations about the responses and suggest some recommendations based on them. The original survey by Westreit and McLean, conducted 13 years ago, was geared explicitly towards lesbians and gays only in its wording. As Susanna Paasonen and Sanna Spisak, as well as Riikka Taavetti have noted, a self-identification based on binary genders was already outdated among the younger queers in 2018 in Finland. So how to word the proper object of a collection project that seeks to queer heteronormative understanding of the lived experience? I was reluctant to address the call non-heterosexuals or sexuals and gender minorities. Such wordings would have implicitly and quite unnecessarily strengthened the misguided idea that heterosexuality is the default sexuality, especially in times when heterosexuality itself is under heavy reconstruction and revision. To be as all-encompassing as possible, I chose to use both for the call and the survey the wording used by the National LGBTQI Human Rights Organization, SETA. People living with sexual and gender diversity, which gives room for a wide variety of experiences without giving preference to any of them. Unlike Westreit and McLean, I also abstained from offering the respondents predefined binary checkboxes. I chose instead a broad and open question. How do you define your gender and sexuality these days? The two little words, these days, proved to be important for many, since they paved way for narrating also temporal change and fluidity. Less fortunate was my decision to conflate gender and sexuality in one question only, since it totally obscured detailed analyses in a case when somebody, for example, answered just with the one word, lesbian. In Finland, the increase in public visibility has recently extended from non-binary genders also to allies. Hence, I decided to invite also allies to participate in the collection of reminiscences with their stories. Consequently, they were included to the call as people living with sexual and gender diversity and their allies, without specifying allies' genders or sexualities any further. The call for most memorable moments was placed on a separate website designed by the Labour Archives in the beginning of June 2018. The site included the call, the query both in Finnish and Swedish, which is the second national language in Finland, as well as further guidelines for making donations to the memory institutions. One could respond also by email or by printing out the form and returning it by mail. The respondents could choose to reply either anonymously or with their full name. If the respondents wanted to participate in a lottery where one could win book prizes, they could leave their contacts for the purpose as well. The query contained some initial demographic information to the person, and then the three questions addressing four memorable events. These concerned personal events affecting one's identity, social, cultural, or historical events or periods affecting one's identity, reminiscences that included intersectional differences, and those that were related to the use of the internet. After each question, the respondent was asked whether the reminiscence can be published as it is, because it does not reveal the identities of the persons involved, or whether it needs to be anonymized further before eventual publishing. By sending in the form, the respondent agreed to its inclusion into the permanent collections of the Labour Archives. To direct the potential respondents to the most memorable moments query, I created a Facebook site with the same title to ignite interest, provoke memories, and urge potential respondents to participate to the collection campaign. For the three summer months, I published daily timed messages featuring some LGBTQ themes or past events with an accompanying image and an encouraging question. Moreover, I passed the call text with links to various LGBTQ websites and email lists, run both by LGBTQ organizations and activists, and the information was added to the circulars and newsletters. Many youth organizations of political parties, which have been vocal about allyship in the recent years, agreed to circulate the call among their members. Furthermore, the call was posted at the email list of gender studies scholars at the university website and at the university website of my home university. Due to its affinity to the Labour archives, the newspaper of the Social Democratic Party published an article about the call, like did the Social Democratic Education Organization on its website. In addition, I visited a major LGBTQ party in Tampere and the Helsinki Pride to deliver in person altogether some 500 small flyers containing the website address and slogans. I also attended a demonstration supporting the rights of non-binary people. Such face-to-face marketing significantly increased the traffic on the website, but did not necessarily result in immediate responses. Despite all these efforts, by the end of the summer, we had amassed some 25 responses only. So the Labour Museum decided to prolong the call to the end of November as to carry out the collecting of the Rainbow History Month, which took place for the first time ever in Finland that autumn. The collaboration with that initiative, especially the cross-references on they and our web and Facebook sites, helped to raise general awareness about the importance of collecting and preserving queer history, as well as created positive hype about the query. Some activists even started to invent novel ways to increase the amount of responses. A Helsinki-based queer activist, Aikku Meura, approached me through the Facebook site and suggested that they could organize a writing cafe for those who would like to share the company of others while responding to the call. Such events where people came together in a cafe with their laptops to ensure productive writing were organized once both in Helsinki and Turku. Eventually, the Labour Archives received 72 replies, which was four times more than the results of the first ever collection campaign for the LGBTQ reminiscences in 2005. It also clearly exceeded Archives collection campaign's usual catch of 50 responses. The responses came from a variety of people who identified by their own terms, either with gender diversity and or sexual diversity and or were allies. Most of the respondents were cis women, which may be due to my person, since I, as the initiator of the call, could be identified as a woman and may already have been known for some as a lesbian scholar because of my publications. A significant minority identified also as non-binary, possibly resulting from the wording of the call, living with gender and or sexual diversity, or because the call eventually started to circulate on Tumblr, where young non-binary people are present these days. Only two of the respondents were cis men, however, and consequently the number of those who identified gay remained very low. Yet relative absence of gay men has been evident also in other comparable women-led collection campaigns in Finland. Apparently, Finnish gay men shy away from responding such calls, either because of simple disinterest or because they fear to be somehow identifiable when offering intimate details about their lives. In a similar vein, while the non-binary scene was rather well presented in the responses, the vibrant drag culture was as good as non-existing in the reminiscences. It was also thought-provoking to notice how few people answered the intersectionality question. It may reflect the fact that in Finland the LGBTQ communities continue to be rather normative and exclusive places where multiple marginalized people still lack voice and language. In any case, in the future, a lot more targeting and encouragement is required to ensure a more gender-balanced and varied participation in similar collection campaigns. The year of birth among the respondents varied from 1941 to 2000, with 1986 as a medium year. The web reliant research design clearly disadvantaged the older generations, as I also noticed when delivering the flyers at the Pride. Because I did not have the printed query at hand, those who were not internet savvy were excluded from participating altogether. Although one of the respondents returned her response by mail, questions of accessibility clearly need more attention. Similarly, I met some persons who did not see themselves as writers per se. They would have been more comfortable telling their stories, as one of the participants did who attended the writing cafe in Turku. This suggests a need to complement the future collection campaigns with oral history interview projects. Yet written reminiscences have their benefits too, as especially the writing cafes demonstrated. Even though the concept as such was a novel one and the number of participants small, the quality of the responses of the people who actually took their time and made an extra effort to come was astonishing. This strongly speaks for developing further the writing cafes as a promising method for collecting reminiscences. In hindsight, it could have made sense to add the question, how did you learn about the collection campaign? In its absence, it is impossible to conclude which kind of marketing was most successful for various respondents. It's also evident that a lot more could have been done in terms of internet marketing. For example, I failed to engage myself with targeted Facebook marketing or to place paid advertisements in gay dating sites. Likewise, most memorable moments did not have a profile of its own on Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram. The received entries make nevertheless evident the diversity beyond clear-cut binary identities in respondent self-identifications. Likewise, the fluidity they portray is undeniable, both in terms of sexuality, but increasingly also in terms of gender. This suggests that the memory institutions who have an interest in collecting and preserving LGBTQ plus histories have to pay serious attention to the scope of their acquisition policies and practices if they want to keep their collections relevant also for the future. And I was also delighted to find that in this conference there is a special session for diversification of archives. Similarly, the inclusion of allies in the collection campaign provided interesting and important information about the changing relations between alleged minority and majority cultures. Other LGBTQ memory institutions currently policing an increasingly outdated boundary between queer and straight, one that seems to be losing of importance in the lives of the LGBTQ and their allies, I wonder. Since the history of allyship is something that still waits to be written, the LGBTQ memory institution could be the places that are able to offer materials also for that kind of scholarship. The responses to the question about the use of the internet made it clear how important medium it has become, especially for the youngest. We take the internet and social media for so self-evident today, yet it is unclear, at least for me, what will be preserved of its content and how well its various forms are even sustainably archivable. To counteract the expected loss of history in a digital era, I would suggest the LGBTQ memory institution to keep actively collecting memories about the past and present uses and meanings of the internet to their target audiences. Such records would help us to understand LGBTQ communities and cultures turn to virtual. One of the questions I was repeatedly asked when delivering the flyers concerned the publication of the responses collected in an archive. This indicated people's keen interest in learning more about the past and present lives of others in their respective communities. So I think the archive should actively seek for ways to give communities something back in return, even if they can't hire researchers to study their collections or artists to make public displays of them, to publish portions of their records, for example during the Rainbow History Month, would keep the dialogue open and ensure future productive collaboration in preserving queer histories. Thank you. And I would also be like extremely happy and glad if there are people around here who have done similar sort of collection campaigns of memories and reminiscences, like maybe to come back to me and give their good and bad advice how to do it, because I think this is something that we continue to do in Finland quite a bit, because the currently, like, Finland is a country with 5 million people, so we are quite a few, and the archives existed only since 2002. And the whole idea of collecting materials into archives and donating materials into archives is still in Finland something that people like struggle to even understand. And therefore, we both need to collect the reminiscences of people so that we kind of know what might be the original like materials that we then could solicit from the people. And then therefore, like, any ideas how we could improve the acquisition would be like more than welcome.
What has been done since with this information?
The information is now in the archive, mm-hmm. so it's publicly available for researchers.
Does the public know that they can find it? Like, is it advertised?
On the Facebook site where I was putting these sort of calls for participating, at the end of the collection campaign, the information was put as the last item there, that it's now safely stored there and it's available for researchers. And that's, I don't know how many people actually have to the date taken advantage of that possibility. There are not that many lesbian, gay or queer scholars even in Finland, but maybe somebody working on their MA thesis might be keen on that, so that could also be a start. I have myself written two articles based on those, or like manuscripts that hopefully get published. And so there's work going on there, going about them. But it's also like some people were asking me, will they be made openly public to the audiences? And I don't think it's a very good idea, because some of the things are very, very personal, and the communities are so tiny that like people immediately know who you are talking about. If it's not anonymized further. And also, like, the answers, somebody answered with just one line, four questions, but just answering one line. And then there were, like, answers with 1,500 words. So they are very uneven as well. So it can't be published as a book, for example, immediately. But I trust there will be work done on those. And they are also very varied in the content, so they totally can't be exhausted by even a couple of researchers.
I was going to ask about the extent of research and writing in Finland about gay, lesbian, queer history and extent.
Sorry, I was going to ask about the extent of research and publishing in Finland around gay, lesbian, queer experiences, history, and so on.
Well, Riikka Taavetti, who I mentioned in one of the slides, published her thesis in done in the Department of History last year, and that was the first ever dissertation written by a historian about lesbian and gay history in Finland, or queer history in Finland. However, non-historians like me have been working on those topics since early 1990s, and there are several publications, mostly written in Finnish, so that makes them less accessible for many of you to read, I guess. And I think currently we have maybe like if I say five people who are funded in Finland to do like almost any kind of lesbian or queer studies. I don't know how much I would be exaggerating. So we are talking about a country where there's a lot of interest and not very many people who actually can professionally work on those issues. And therefore, for the time being, what I find very important is that we preserve the materials that maybe at some point somebody will have the time and the money to actually do the research. And I'm really, really happy that Workers' Museum and Archives have sort of seized the moment and as I mentioned, they now have the national responsibility to do so as well. So it's no longer depending on me, for example, only.
I'm Richard Keeble from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. I'm a colleague of Graham's. I'm not sure if this is a question, so I'll say at the beginning, have you considered? ALGA, the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives, has a very strong social media presence, particularly on Facebook, but also on Twitter. And as an organisation, we're constantly making other people aware of our activities by posting regularly on social media. It feels to me that you have material that you could maybe once every 2 weeks or once a week or once a month put out on a social media feed, be that Tumblr or Facebook or Instagram, and draw attention to the work that you do and hopefully build up followers over time that may be able to bring in more information when you do these surveys of people to gather their memories. Is that something that you've considered to do in the past?
Well, as Graham mentioned, I work at the University of Turku. I'm a researcher and I'm collaborating with these institutions, but I don't work there. And as also mentioned, they are labor archives and labor museums, which have a wide variety of tasks and like little funding, and you know the story. They put some stuff on their own social media website, but that website, because it's like a general website and not a lesbian and gay specific one, is not finding the audiences that you and I would be keen to have. So what we have done extensively is to use the Rainbow History Month as a sort of focal point to attract people's interest, and that has also worked quite well. These messages get around, but what clearly needs to be done is to improve this ongoing presence. And for example, we are now negotiating the possibility that in Turku Pride, for example, there would be collaboration with the University of Turku and my research project and these archives and memory institutions so that the word can be spread around. So, yeah.
I'm also reminded that in Australia there are Facebook groups, for example, Lost Gay Melbourne and Lost Gay Sydney. And these aren't academic websites. These are community websites, and people who are looking for somebody else or have a reminiscence about somebody will just post things, and these things occur organically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking perhaps if there was a Lost Gay Finland or a Lost Gay Turku or something like that, that may be able to draw an audience for yourself, and if you're lucky, it might be self-sustaining.
Yeah. I have visited your Lost Melbourne, for example, and I loved it. And a colleague of mine actually put up like Lost Lesbis Finland or something like that. I can't even remember the title. And in Finland, people seem to be shy. You don't get that type of, like, I have posted myself some like pictures of me going for the first time ever in a lesbian bar with my girlfriend. And I was expecting to have like tons of others. Never happened. So we try, but it's still like, we'll probably take some time.
Two words, drag queens.
Thank you for that.
Other questions or comments? Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The third speaker is Karolina Ufa, who volunteers at the Fundacja Q in Poland. And who knows how to find her paper?
Okay, hello everyone. And my name is Karolina Ufa, and I'm volunteering in Fundacja Q, Foundation Q, in Poland, in Warsaw. We are really honored to be here because we are a really young organization, and we are happy to share with you our experience. The purpose of my talk today is to present Foundation Q activities and to put it in the context of existing queer archives in Poland. And the beginning, I will focus especially on the organizational, financial and institutional framework that Polish LGBTQ plus collections are embedded in. And later I will speak about our virtual museum. I will address this issue from the perspective of practitioner who not only collecting archival material, but also organizing and describing, although I might lack some academic reflection from meta level of discipline, so I will be really happy if you can also contribute it and maybe to give me some background. So far in Poland, we have no public blanket, complete, easily accessible LGBTQ archive. The resources are scattered all around the country and stays in the hands of NGOs, informal groups, and private people. One of the reasons is the relatively young stage of queer movement reinforced by persistent homophobia in the public institutions, including state archives and national libraries. Therefore, like in many other countries, the responsibility to preserve the history of non-heteronormative people rests on the shoulders of grassroots organizations and individuals. The most of the resources documenting Polish queer history are organized as a community archives. And by community archives, we are understanding the definition given by Andrew Flynn, that it's a grassroots activities of documenting, recording, and exploring community heritage, in which community participation, control, and ownership of the project is essential. And Polish queer archival projects follow such definition. They are created from below. That means they have no institutional support, and their existence is a result of citizen activity and their passion to past and history, an effect of belief that some recordings are worth to preserve. They are set by different subjects, as I mentioned before, and they are in the various types and forms, like photographs, oral stories, personal memoirs, pamphlets, and many more. They are almost always lacking professional archival staff who take care of them. The landscape of grassroots archival projects changes constantly. In most cases, they are really small, ephemeral. They are set up and they fall with the end of organization or death of its founder. And as I mentioned before, there are alternatives to official system, which in Poland depends exclusively on state financial support and changeable political context. On the other hand, since a few years, we can observe the growing interest in supporting this kind of collection from state side. They are now in the scope of attention of National Directory of State Archives, the main body in Poland that take care of archives. And there is a special amendment in the law from 2016 that NGOs that keep community archives can be beneficiaries of granting programs. However, this funding is less available for the projects that deal with the progressive issue like feminist movement or queer communities. And so far, none of the LGBTQ plus focused history group has received such kind of support. We tried once and we were not accepted. Our project was not accepted. So in such institutional and cultural landscape, the historical club LGBTQI Femme came into the life in February 2017, and it was followed by creation of our foundation in 2017, in the summer. Initially, we were the group on Facebook that wanted to popularize queer history and share with our followers the queer archives that we own. We came with this idea of the space where all resources, materials concerning Polish LGBT community could be preserved, presented, and used for educational purposes. We started by posting a Facebook call for any type of records, as well we used our contacts to communicate with former activists and ask them to donate their collection to historical club. At the beginning, we received just few zines and gay magazines, but Drops joined to make a stream. With time, more people trusted us and shared with us their private collection of photographs, pamphlets, personal documents, or even a correspondence. And some of the materials that we have, they are still in our hands, and some of them we are only able to scan and keep digital copy. What is worth to mention, it's the scope of our archive. You can see it's beautiful, it's 10 boxes from IKEA. And at present, we have more than 400 pages from different magazines and journals, 100 posters, 50 different kinds of photos, around 300 up to 400 leaflets, zines, and short-run printed materials, and also 20 oral history recordings. Right now, we have a list of 100 activists that we would like to interview about their engagement in the queer movement. We have a particular interest in the history of queer activism in Poland, owing to the ways in which its suppression has had an historic influence on queer rights in Poland. This is one of the photos that we received. It's a first meeting of a Kraków Lesbian Lambda little group. So it's quite important for us to have it. And our little successes. I mentioned this photo, but also we received the archive of the first legally registered LGBTQ organization, Association of Lambda Groups, that was set up in 1990. And also received a folder from one of the first lesbian groups called Abilities. We have some documents created by this group, and also one of the first leaflet about AIDS, HIV, and lesbian sex. Yes, so right, and we are mainly focusing also on the years 1990 and 2000. Before the 90s, there were no deliberate institutional queer archives. The first organization, as I mentioned, was in 1990, and the year 2000 is a limit day for two reasons. First, it's the year when internet became a widely accessible tool for communication, so a lot of activism came into the online world, on the virtual world. And the second thing is that two really important magazines, Inaczej and Filo, finished their existence. And also this period is a period when we still have many sources, printed sources, and we could ask activists about their experience from the first hand. One of our goals for the next few years is to create a completely 100% online collection so everyone can access to it and become familiar with it. We landed with this idea that it's the easiest way to reach the audience in Poland. An idea to digitize the archive is also very pragmatic. The majority of archives are made of paper, so it means that really easy to damage and degrade. We cooperate with the Karta Center Foundation. It's the organization that created some application for describing, publishing, and searching community archival collection. And thanks to their special application called OSA, Open Archiving System, we are able to publish our materials within the standards of International Council on Archives. And also to do so, to make our online collection, we need to upload into the system and describe a few thousand pages. And it takes about, we counted, 20 minutes to enter one page with appropriate description. So in total, it will take like 80,000 minutes to upload all the materials we have. And for one person, it means work 8 hours per day, 7 days per week for half a year. And I must say that we are all volunteers, so none of us is getting anything. So it's a job after our normal jobs. And recently, to fulfill our goal, we started a crowdfunding campaign. We received only 13% of the amount of money we really wanted. We dedicated to our archival activities, and we know also we are aware that that our activities are not so sexy and emotionally moving as other campaigns. Maybe that's the reason why it didn't get enough funds. if you would like to see how this online app looks for archiving, community archives, you can access this this website. I think we don't have a time to see it right now. And now I will go to our second project that we are implementing right now. It's a LGBTQ plus virtual museum. And it supports our archive by presenting our collection in a synthesized and more understandable way. We think that maybe public will be more interested in this kind of the knowledge and visualization of the history of queer community in Poland. And our museum makes marginalized narratives more visible and tell the story of non-heteronormative people's constant existence alongside heteronormative majority in Poland. We are the museum was created in cooperation with Google Arts and Culture. So far we hosted three exhibitions. Its inaugural exhibition showcased posters of different Polish organizations. The idea was to show the fragment of the history of queer organization activity told by posters. And we have seven or eight different organizations that donate us their posters, and we are showing them, presenting them on our website. Then the next two were concerning Action Hyacinth. It was the raid against Polish homosexuals between year 1985 and 1987. And as a result, 11,000 people were registered in so-called pink files. And in the contrary to the physical museum, our virtual museum doesn't entail renting space, buying display, and insuring exhibits. However, running it causes some challenges. The most of the times, the issue is about showing the material, visual material. We are facing some problems about internal rules, for example, nudity policy. We are told that our material is too erotic or too pornographic, and you can see one of the photo. The issue was that we show belly button. So they asked us to edit it, and then the issue was about the hug. So in the end, we didn't post this photo. The second problem that we are facing right now, it's ethical question about publication of oral history interviews that we have, because we are thinking like which part of data we can reveal, how much we can show, and what will be the outcome of such publication. Of course, we are taking the agreement from the people that we are interviewing, but still we are afraid how in this political climate in Poland these interviews can be, what will be the impact on the life of the activists, for example. And to wrap it up, we think that in current political climate, going digital is the way to preserve and promote queer history with no chance for state financial and infrastructural support. We try to create a user experience that doesn't exist physically, but provide opportunity for everyone to learn without having to travel. And it is so important now because we are observing that populist and right-wing organizations and parties are trying to redefine the history. They're telling us who is the hero and who is not, and it's created a history with a lot of gaps. And we are trying actually to show that LGBTQ plus community was always part of the Polish history, is a part of Polish history, and will be the part of Polish history. And we should contradict this. If you would like to queer with us the history, you can support our crowdfunding campaign. You can contact us via social media, email, or traditional post. And we are really open to share with you our archives, our sources, and to cooperate. So thank you a lot.
I'll make a comment.
Yes, please.
You have, I think, 10 IKEA archive boxes,
yes,
of material. In some respect, you're lucky. ALGA has 550 shelf meters of material, and we're relatively small compared to other LGBTIQ archives. You're in a position where you can get all of your collection digital fairly quickly and get it online fairly quickly. And I think that's something that you should embrace within the limitations of what you can do in terms of privacy and pornography. So having a small collection and being able to start from scratch is in some respects, a real benefit to you.
Thank you a lot.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation. I have a question about your team. How many are you in the team? And also, what are the biggest challenges for you in starting and maintaining the work? Thank you.
Okay, so right now in the core team, we are 4 people. So it's really like a small team. We have one person who graduate archive history and so on. So we have like this output from the academic background. We have 2 psychologists and 1 political scientist. So I think it's also good to have this one. About the challenges, I think the time and the money, because we don't have, I mean, like we cover our expenses to going and recording the interviews from our own pocket. So even to have some few euro to just pay for the petrol to go to the person, to former activist, and let her or him to tell us the story, it will be really good and nice to have.
Hi, this is just a comment. Yeah. I just want to say how impressed I am of what you're doing with almost no resources, no staff, no institutional support, that you guys are just doing this on your own. It's really, really amazing. And also, as you mentioned, in a very conservative political climate, it's well done.
My question was, at the Amsterdam ALMS some years back, I got the impression that there was a push from the bigger Western European archives, museums, libraries, especially LGBTQ, to support the smaller emerging East European ones. Did you get any of that kind of support from
the West? Right now, no, but we're trying to network, maybe find someone who would like to help us also. But I know that some Polish other LGBTQ archives are getting support from the Western organizations.
Okay,
thank you a lot.
I have one announcement that was passed to me from the organisers about water. Water is available with lunch on the terrace. Tomorrow, though, please bring water for the morning. So if you need bottled water, bring it with you. They're currently working on arranging a water station where we can fill our bottles. But in the meantime, it's kind of look after yourself, really. But it'll be there at lunchtime. Okay, so thank you for getting us off to a really good start. I thought that was a really interesting range of papers and efforts at all kinds of different levels with all kinds of issues. I think that's kind of got us set us up to think about some of those issues over the next few days. Thanks very much.